Les colloques du Collège de France.
Hi everyone, it's a great honor and pleasure to be part of this absolutely fantastic lineup. And like everyone else, I will start with wishing Stan a happy birthday and giving a 30-second introduction to how I ended up working with Stan. I was trained a theoretical computer scientist, and for whatever reason, I didn't fully embrace this, so I went sailing for a year. Which you might imagine is a lot of adventure, but really is a lot of time to read and do nothing. And I was reading Stan's book, and I was getting really interested in moving into cognitive neuroscience. And so I sent him an email, dear Professor Dehaene, can I transition and go in your lab? And to which he very kindly replied, sure, come, let's meet at Neurospin. But then I said, I'm really sorry, the best I can do is Skyping from my boat, from a cafe in Le Paris. Which is the very small, which was a cafe at the small isthmus there. And as you can see, I had a lot of time on my hand. And Stan replied, okay, you're hired. and then eventually we ended up having, a chat on the phone. And from this followed many years of absolute nonstop scientific fun. But this is, sort of how this whole started for me. And in that very phone call, he described the question that would end up guiding the years that I spent working with him, which is, why do humans care so much about geometry? And when you think of geometry, you might be tempted to think of Euclid's Element 2,000 years ago. But really, humans have produced regular patterns for much longer than this. You find these kind of spiral engravings from 5,000 years ago in America. These zigzag patterns 70,000 years ago in South Africa, or the zigzag on shells in Java. And there's another timeline you can rewind, which is the developmental timeline. If you ask a kid to draw a person, you get this sort of like very unrealistic but very geometric depiction, which is even rewarded by the parents. Or if you let them draw freely, they will produce these kind of things and then describe them as railroad or trains or whatever it is that they want to represent. And when you get access to the wonderful facility of Stan's lab, one thing you can do is immediately start asking these questions with an incredible array of methods. And so, for example, I tackled onto an fMRI project and added simple geometric shapes in a sort of classic visual localizer. So you present blocks of shapes, blocks of faces, and so on, and you look at which areas in the brain are more activated by shapes than by other visual categories. So here, for example, shapes versus faces, objects, and houses. And when you do this, you find a set of area, notably the IPS, that overactivates compared to the other categories. And this is a result that's true in adults. It's very replicable. It's true in children as well. And this is an area you've seen a lot in the past few days because Lorenzo presented it. It's an area you find in all sorts of math tasks. Andrea Snyder showed that this is the kind of area where you find numbers in macaques. And so the simple, passive, sort of no-task presentation of geometric shapes already elicits an overactivation of these areas. On top of things of this, though, geometric shapes are more or less complex in humans. Not all of the shapes are the same. And so the next question was, can we understand what makes some shapes simpler than others? And so we designed a bunch of quadrilateral shapes organized by geometric regularity, from the most regular on the top left to the most irregular one on the bottom right. And one task that I'm going to present here is an intruder task, where you have to find the shapes that's different from the others. And here it's fairly easy. It's the one on the bottom left. But as described by Aaron this morning, you can use these kind of tasks to estimate the dissimilarity between shapes, how different any two shape is, by just doing this task over and over again with different pairs of shapes, which we did in a bunch of participants, and that gives you a nice estimate of the similarity or dissimilarity between any two shapes. And then the question is, can we find theories of why certain shapes should be more similar than others? And on the one hand, we used a sort of symbolic model that counts the number of geometric regularities and says two shapes, so symbolic regularities, here I mean number of parallel sides, number of right angles, number of sides of equal length, and says two shapes are as similar as they share these sort of high-level features. And the counterpoint to this is a bottom-up visual network of object processing, which is there to approximate the visual pathway. And so we took a state-of-the-art at the time neural network, propagated the shapes through, and measure the distance in the internal layers of the network. Once you have these two models, you can again generate these similarity or dissimilarity matrices, and then you can use this to model behavior. And if you do this, you find that humans are massively predicted by the geometric features. They're also predicted by the other model, but to a lesser extent. And that's true in a cohort of about 300 participants, which we tested online. These are educated adults. But this result is really stable. I don't have time to present this, but it's true in first graders. It's true in HIMBAs, which have been mentioned by Lorenzo, who are adults without access to formal Western education. It's true in blind participants using haptic stimuli. And to the best of what we've been able to do so far, it doesn't replicate in baboons, which suggests that this sensitivity is really something that is specific to humans. That methodology nicely extends to neuroimaging work. And again, when you're at Neurospin, this is the kind of tools that you have access to. And so the next thing was to do an MEG version of an experiment like this to understand the neural correlates and the neural dynamics of these representations. And so we had participants sitting in the MEG, and we were presenting them shapes once per second by blocks. So it's 30 seconds of seeing mostly squares, and then 30 seconds of seeing mostly rectangles, and so on. Participants do this for an hour. They're very patient. There's no task whatsoever. They're just passively looking. And then we take the average activity for one shape, the average activity for another at a particular time point. We look at how similar these two things are in the sensor space. We do this for all pairs of shapes, and that gives you, again, a dissimilarity matrix, but now it's a dissimilarity matrix based on the neural activity elicited by these shapes. And you do this at each time point. And when you do this, you find that the early neural activity is driven by the neural network of shape perception up to something like 200, 250 milliseconds. But there's another significant cluster associated to the geometric feature model, which starts a little later and lasts until about 400 milliseconds. And without going into too much details, what you can do is then project this back into the space of sources on the cortical surface. And when you do this, you find sort of reassuringly that the neural network gets projected to the occipital areas, but the other network activates a whole parietofrontal set of sources. This line of work I'm continuing thanks to collaboration with Yan Zeliu. I've been able to get data from intracranial in patients, which mostly replicates just about everything I've shown you with the MEG, but I'm not going to go into more details here. We also collaborated with Paolo Papale and Peter Rufselma to collect data from the visual cortex of macaques, because there's still this question of understanding the extent to which this is specific to humans. And the data quality is amazing. We can decode all of these shapes. But there's no evidence that some shapes are represented easier than other, neither in decoding or in the sort of dissimilarity analysis that are presented. Although, of course, this is data coming from the visual cortex, where we also don't find this difference in humans, and so far this is inconclusive. And the next step is to collect data from the frontal cortex of macaque, which I've started to find collaborators to do recently. So as a sort of interim summary, the passive perception in fMRI indicates that simply perceiving geometric shapes activates a math network, and we can split the activity into a sort of perceptual component and a symbolic component, which are separated in space and time. And there's some preliminary evidence that maybe this is unique to humans. And that's a sort of, to me anyway, really interesting computational level description of what's going on. But there's no idea of what the algorithms underlying this are. And this is where we bring in some classic ideas of the language of thoughts into the picture, saying maybe the way people represent geometric shapes is by having internal generative program that generates these shapes. And so inspired by prehistoric findings about different shapes, we came up with a generative language for shapes. Those of you who learn to program with Logo and have drawn things with a little turtle, this is sort of similar to these kind of things, but more ad hoc to predict human productions. And without going into a lot of details, this language really needs a few sort of control primitives that are saying you can repeat a program or you can concatenate two programs, and then a few tracing primitives that are integration parameter over a pen that moves on a piece of paper. And then once you have a description of a language like this, what you can do is recursively enumerate all of the programs, generate the associated shapes, and so you get a set of shapes ranked by the length of their program. And the intuition here is, if you represent these shapes with an internal program like this, then shapes with a longer program should elicit should be harder to understand, and so in all sorts of behavior tasks they should be harder to use. And so for this we used a delayed match to sample. Participants see a shape, and then there's a blank screen for 2 seconds, and then they have to recognize these shapes in a set of distractors. But there's a twist, which is that participants self-pace the duration during which they look at the first one. And so that gives us access to an introspective measure of how complex they think a shape is. And of course, we also collect response time and accuracy. And on all of these measures, shapes that have longer program on average take longer. So participants look longer at shapes that are more complex, and they also take longer to recognize them. But if you look at the examples on the left, which are ranked by the length of their program, you might have the intuition that all sorts of things correlate with program length, like visual frequency or the average luminance, number of subparts, and so on. But if you list many of these properties and you include everything in a regression, what you find is, of course, many of these features impact behavior. Of course, visual frequency has an impact on detecting, on recognizing the shape. But crucially, the length of the shortest program is still a significant predictor of their behavior. So here I'm sort of claiming that the way we represent these things is with these shapes it with program. But of course, there's the question of how you come up with a program. When you see a shape, how do you internally come up with a program? This is a notoriously hard problem in computer science. It's called the program induction problem. It gets exponentially hard as programs get longer because you have to search a set that grows exponentially quickly. Usually I spend a little bit of time trying to argue that this is feasible in some restricted context, but today I'm lucky because I come before Josh and he's going to give a much better explanation of program induction and how to tackle the complexity associated to it. And so I'm not going to go into any details here. But this still leaves us with a puzzle. I've given you a computational description of something and an algorithmic hypothesis. But at the end of the day, you know, the biological brain need to be able to implement these symbols and these operations. And it's still sort of a mystery how it's actually happening. But very excitingly, these past few years, a number of papers have been published, which are sort of planting flags on the way there. One of them was presented recently from Liping 2 days ago, if you were paying attention and you still remember. It's a task with sequences, and what they find is that macaques represent these sequences of three items with three orthogonal subspaces associated to the rank of the different items. And so there's a subspace for rank 1, 2, and 3, which are separate, where they project identity of what they have to remember. In a sort of related task in mice, Mohamedi El-Ghabi has found independent orthogonal subspaces in a task where mice have to remember a sequence of locations where they have to go and get a reward. And the representation is actually quite similar, but there's a difference in the task, which is that the mice have to do this over and over again. So once they get to the fourth reward, they have to go to the first one, get the reward, and so on. And so there's a small difference, which is while in Liping's presentation, these subspaces are rank 1, 2, and 3, they're sort of index based. In the mice, it's sort of egocentric based. It's the current one, the next one, the one after, and so on. And the whole information rotates because they have to do this over and over again. And these findings got me really excited because it could be an intuition for a mechanistic implementation of a sequence of item that repeats. And when you're coming from the language of thought literature, you've seen a lot of papers whose first primitive that they have to describe is repetition. And so having an implementation, if only for that, would be really exciting. But of course, what you would want from a primitive like this is that it scales. If you can repeat something, you should also be able to do a repetition of repetition. And so I inspired by these findings, I designed an experiment to test this in humans who have to remember a very long sequence of 24 items. But the sequences have a lot of structure. They're organized by groups of three items that repeat, and then another group of three items that repeat, and then the whole sequence repeats again, right? So it's 24 items, but really you can get away with remembering six and remember the structure. And the kind of models that I've presented before make different predictions depending on how they scale when repetition increases. Maybe you never have access to the two levels of repetitions, and if that's the case, then you can only realize that there's a period of 12 and you have 12 orthogonal subspaces, and this is going to work, but it's very expensive because you're, in a sense, remembering twice as many things as you need to. But you could also have three orthogonal ABC subspaces and three orthogonal DEF subspaces, and there are two ways in which you could select these two, which is either you have two separate subspaces and you have an attentional mechanism that is different that tells you look at one or look at the other, or you have these two subspaces and they themselves are embedded as subspaces that rotate half the time. And so the mechanism for the local subspaces would also be the mechanism for the global subspaces, which would indicate that the mechanism for repetition can scale at these two levels. So I collected MEG data. You can sort of tease apart these different models by doing similarity analysis. In the visual cortex, none of these models is predictive of anything that's happening, which is reassuring. But in the frontal cortex, this hierarchical model, the one where you have three subspaces for ABC, three subspaces for DEF, and an attention mechanism that alternates between the two, significantly predicts the neural activity. I think that's interesting because this is not necessarily the one that I would have predicted, because it's not the one that's scaling, it's not the one that's using the same mechanism at both levels. But I've learned 2 days ago that it seems that this is also what Liping is finding in his own data, where the mechanism for the level one repetition and the level two structure are actually different. And so to conclude, I would like to say that all of this provides converging evidence that the mental representation of something as simple as a geometric shape goes beyond the usual mechanisms of visions, that the perception of shapes yields math-like networks, that feedforward network can capture the visual activity, but you need exact geometric feature to capture more general neural activity. That these sort of algorithmic representation as a language of thought are a good predictor of behavior. And hopefully, thanks to the compositional nature of language of thoughts, you only need to give mechanistic account of a few primitives to get the hope of explaining a wide array of representations. And with this, I would like to thank Stan again, who's hiding here in a set of rusted steel beams, as well as everyone who's supervised me and collaborated with me on these projects. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.